for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. By most accounts, the 114th Congress got off to a slow start with stalemates that threatened to shut down the Department of Homeland Security and delayed confirmation of a new attorney general. But some say recent weeks have shown important signs of bipartisan cooperation. Here to look at the first 100 days of the Republican-led Congress and what's to come, James Thurber of American University, Ruth Marcus at The Washington Post, and Stephen Dinant of The Washington Times. To join us, call us on 800-433-8850. Send an email to drshow@wamu.org. Follow us on Facebook, or you can send us a tweet. Welcome to all of you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
James Thurber, how would you characterize the start of this new Congress?
Well, it's a start where the president needs to protect his legacy and expand his legacy, and the Republicans have to show that they can govern. And the first month of this Congress, they stumbled a lot. They passed a bill that would establish the Keystone Pipeline, and it was vetoed. They also stumbled on Homeland Security, trying to get the president to back off an executive order, helping 4 million people here in the United States, citizens, not citizens, but help them in a pathway to citizenship. They have made some progress, though, recently. On the budget, surprisingly, the budget's only been passed four times since 1976, and the Republicans are really moving very rapidly on that. But remember, it's not a piece of legislation. It's a guideline to all the committees on the Hill to cut back or to expand spending, to expand the tax base or cut back on taxes. So it's not as serious as some of the other things. There are a couple of other things that they're moving rapidly on. One is trade. The Trade Promotion Authority, which is an authority to consider trade bills, one in the Far East now and one in Europe, TTIP in Europe, and to do it without amendments. It's very important to get that through. It's very close. There'll be some Democrats that vote for the Republicans, and many people think the president will get that in a coalition with the Republicans.
Ruth Marcus, one area where you think he stumbled is military authorization to go up against ISIS.
Well, you know, you can look at the start of this Congress and you can argue the glass half full case and you can argue the glass half empty case. And if you look in particular at the issue of the inevitable and constant and constitutionally prescribed tug of war between the executive branch and Congress, you can actually make that glass half full, glass half empty argument. So you look at the authorization for the use of military force, where the president, to his credit, sent up a proposal for a new authorization, which is badly needed because the current one is it stretches it beyond comprehension to apply it to the current conflict with ISIS, and it has gone precisely nowhere in Congress. They have not taken up what I think is their constitutional role to be involved in here. At the same time, we saw a remarkable and really quite cheering, from my point of view, this week, move at the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, where unanimously, the committee approved and the president said, despite the fact that he really privately loathes it, that he will not veto a measure to give Congress a role in approving or disapproving the nuclear deal with Iran. And I think that is a testament to a few things. Senator Corker and some Democratic counterparts, Senator Cardin, Senator Kaine, Senator Menendez, really cooperating to assert their joint congressional interest vis-a-vis the executive branch.
Stephen Dinant, is there a different atmosphere right now after this first 100 days?
There are issues where there are a different atmosphere. I don't know that I would say overall, but I was particularly heartened by the progress on this Medicare, the so-called doc fix, as it's called. And this is an issue that's been around for nearly two decades. The 1997 budget bill actually imposed future cuts on payments to doctors as a budget-cutting method. Starting in the early 2000s, those cuts were supposed to start taking place, and Congress looked at them and said, we're not going to cut the doctors who are treating Medicare patients, so we're going to start patching that. And they patched it with short-term patches, sometimes, you know, a couple of months, sometimes a couple of years, 17 different times. Finally, Nancy Pelosi and John Boehner got together and created a deal that is a permanent patch for that. Republicans got a little bit of what they wanted. Democrats got a lot of what they wanted. You know, I look at legislating two different ways. There's the least common denominator legislating, which is where every side does the bare minimum that they can all agree to, or there's the compromise style, which is where somebody gets a little of what they want and gives on what they don't want, and vice versa. Who would have ever thought you'd be talking about a Boehner-Pelosi compromise on anything, much less on entitlements a few months ago? So there are issues where there are very, very positive signs.
But you wouldn't go so far as to say overall.
No, but I would say that there are a couple of things we don't know. It'll take time until we know whether this is happening. But that Medicare deal could be the symbol. First of all, it's the first time that the House, a bipartisan House deal, has been written, and basically the Senate's been told take it or leave it in years, probably a decade or more. It's also it could be the beginning of basically Democrats settling into the minority role there and realizing that if House Democrats want to have a say in legislation themselves rather than through Senate Democrats, if they want to have a say in legislation, they will have to strike deals with Boehner and then use those to go to the Senate.
The doc fix, as Stephen points out, is an important moment. And in terms of the ability to compromise and get along, it is a cheering moment. But I am going to inject a small icing of cynicism on that, which is the one way in which both sides can get along is if they're asserting themselves against the president. The other way they can all agree to get along is by agreeing to spend more money. So they solve the problem through deficit spending, hundreds of billions of dollars in the future. And so that's a lot easier than making the hard choices of what to cut. So important move, reasonable fix, but at a certain cost.
But there are other things in that bill that that are not in the headlines. One is the expansion of SCHIP. So it's an insurance system for children that live below the poverty system, below the poverty level. They also increased fees for certain people in Medicare, depending on their income, a means test, which was needed to bring in some money. And they also funded clinics throughout the United States. The doc fix is very important, but these other things are important, too. So there's a little bit of everything there. What they did is they marginalized the far right in the Senate and the House, and they're very upset. But they went ahead with a coalition with Republicans and Democrats.
But tell me, doesn't this constitute something of a compromise, the beginnings of which may carry us further, Ruth?
Yes, that's very possible. For example, there are conversations right now about the badly needed reauthorization and update to No Child Left Behind that I'm told are proceeding very positively in the Senate, where serious lawmakers on both sides are trying to craft a compromise. But there is always another hand when you're talking about congressional function versus dysfunction. So I would put on the other hand there the unbelievable and quite maddening stalling of the confirmation of Loretta Lynch, the nominee for Attorney General, who is entirely qualified to do the job, has the votes to get the job, is now snarled in a completely unrelated issue involving abortion politics and a sex trafficking bill on which everybody fundamentally agrees that the underlying bill is a good idea. So if you needed an example of remaining congressional dysfunction, I'd look there.
Isn't there a hunger strike that's beginning on that issue?
I'm not familiar with the hunger strike.
Yeah, but apparently a hunger strike about to take place. Jim.
If I might add to this, the House of Representatives went forward with an education bill, with amendments to the Elementary and Secondary Education Act, so-called No Child Left Behind amendments, and they had to withdraw it because they didn't have enough votes, and it was an embarrassment to the leader. So there are two different kinds of constituencies. There's the House that are compact, non-competitive, only 31 seats were competitive, with people worried about being challenged in the primary. And so they're going to stand on this abortion thing. They're going to try to cut back on No Child Left Behind, on testing requirements from the federal government. It's very hard to get those people together. Senate's easier. Boehner's going to have to reach out, as he has a couple times now, and bring in Democrats, even though very few people vote together. As we know, it's extreme polarization left and right, nobody in the middle.
And this is all about 2016, isn't it, Stephen?
That's certainly going to get involved here very soon, and we'll make a lot of these compromises probably disappear in a few months, if not even sooner.
I wonder whether you're going to see more compromises as Republicans realize they've got to gain more votes from Hispanics, from other groups that perhaps they won't have unless they do compromise. We're going to take a short break here. When we come back, we'll get a little more about that Iran oversight bill and what it entails. Stay with us.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Vicky and Roger Sant and Island Press, which offers solutions to environmental problems in print, in person, and online at islandpress.org. From American University Washington College of Law, registration at wcl.american.edu/summer. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, supporting creative people and effective institutions committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information is at macfound.org.
And welcome back. Ruth Marcus of The Washington Post, Jane Thurber of American University, whose forthcoming book is titled American Gridlock, The Sources, Characteristics, and Impact of Polarization. That's coming out soon. And Stephen Dynan, he's Congressional Bureau Chief for The Washington Times. We are going to take your calls, 800-433-8850. Send us an email or follow us on Facebook or send us a tweet. Stephen, tell us about this Iran oversight bill, what it entails, and what happened.
So the initial bill had covered a number of different areas in addition to the Iran nuclear program. It also dealt with Iran's support for terrorism and a few other ancillary issues. The compromise that emerged this week happened because Republicans, at least for now, have agreed not to touch those ancillary issues such as support for terrorism. And they also agreed to adjust the time frames within the bill that Congress has to review a deal. The fundamental bill as it stands now is that the president, several days, I think 10 days or so after he reaches a final agreement with Iran, will submit the deal itself and submit several certifications and assessments of Iran's ability and willingness to comply with the deal to Congress. That begins a time frame. Congress has a certain period of time in which they have to review it and pass either a resolution of approval, giving support for it, a resolution of disapproval, or taking no action. If they pass a resolution of approval, everything is fine. If they take no action, the president continues and the sanctions get lifted. And if they pass a resolution of disapproval, then it begins a situation the president then has a veto and Congress would have to go through a veto override. So the burden would be on Congress to override the president's deal if it wanted to. The sanctions would remain in place for, I believe it's 30 days after the deal is reached. And then if Congress takes no action, the sanctions disappear. If Congress approves the deal, the sanctions disappear. If Congress disapproves, you have this further legislating.
So why did the president finally go along with this, Ruth?
Because he can count. And that's the only reason. This was, from the congressional point of view, this was really a triumph of precisely what we want to see, both in public and behind the scenes, between Republicans and Democrats. Because Bob Corker of Tennessee, the chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee, faced a bunch of folks in his party who wanted even more control. They didn't understand why this wasn't a treaty. They wanted the Senate to have a two-thirds affirmative vote for it to take place. Tim Kaine played a critical role negotiating with Bob Corker from the Democratic point of view and reflecting some of the White House concerns, some of the things that Stephen mentioned, getting out these extraneous issues like terrorism, focusing entirely on the congressional sanctions, which was appropriate, things like that. That part worked perfectly. What was surprising to me was the degree to which the White House role seemed to be, we hate this, we hate this, we hate this, and until it became clear that it was going to pass, unanimously out of the Foreign Relations Committee, they were just all about what was wrong with it and not very much about trying to fix it.
The system is working. The Congress is standing up in the area of foreign policy, defense policy. It's advise and consent. It's not a treaty that's being considered, and so they want to make it like a treaty, and I think that's appropriate, and they've got various stages for doing that, and I think they've shown that they can get together on something external, a threat to the United States, and vote together at the committee level.
What about the president's use of executive power? Has he kind of taken that as far as he could go?
Yesterday he said in a town meeting that he's gone as far as he can on executive orders. He's done it with respect to illegal immigrants in the United States. He's done it with respect to promulgation rules and regulations on old coal-fired plants for EPA. He's done it to a certain extent with this Iran nuclear agreement, although that is typical of most presidents approaching it that way. I think he'll continue to use executive orders.
You do.
But also pushing agencies to promulgate rules and regulations around legislation that's fairly vague, and they put the specificity on the law, and they'll direct it in the way he wants it. It's happening at OSHA. It's happening at EPA. Outside the executive order, it's happening in these regulatory agencies. So he'll continue to do that.
Stephen, what do you think? Has he reached that limit?
So I guess I would say the president 4 or 5 years ago said he didn't have powers to act on immigration, and then ahead of the 2012 election suddenly discovered powers to act on immigration and said at that point he'd gone as far as he could, and then in November of last year suddenly discovered even more powers. So, you know, saying he's hit his limit, I don't know that I would believe that he really thinks he is at his limit. That may be more a political limit than an actual legal limit that he realizes.
I'm respectfully dissent from Stephen's characterization of the president's evolution on the issue of his executive powers. You know, we can go back and parse the words of what he said he didn't have power to do. It is very clear that this president, like his predecessors, has been increasingly muscular, especially in a second term, especially facing an opposition Congress, in his use of executive power. And the most a muscular manifestation of that clearly has been on the issue of immigration authority. And that is also the area in which the congressional resentment of that is at its apex. And that has, you know, spillover effects in the ability of the two branches to get along.
So everybody knows this, but we have divided party government. It's very hard to govern when you have that. He had a 97% presidential support score. It's a batting average of what you want, what you get. In his first two terms, it's higher than Clinton at 86%, higher than Eisenhower at 82%, and it dropped down to 30% when he had divided party government. When you have divided party government, you move to other means, executive orders. Bush did, all of our presidents said, it's the norm in American politics over the last 40 years to have divided party government, and presidents will use other means to pursue their policies.
Stephen, what about, as Jim mentioned, the trade area? Do you think there's lots of room for compromise there?
There's probably a very narrow political window for getting enough votes to get it done. There are a lot of moving parts there, and I'm going to toss out three different acronyms, and these all get very confusing. You have TPA, which is Trade Promotion Authority. That is the bill that would give, as you mentioned earlier, that's the bill that would give the president the ability to negotiate and essentially give Congress an up or down vote at the end, as opposed to Congress having the ability to adjust it, which basically means you have to negotiate with 535 different members of Congress if you're
right.
a foreign country. So that's TPA. You
okay.
have TPP, which is the Trans-Pacific Partnership. That is this Asian trade deal that is the key reason why Congress is trying to rush to finish the TPA. And you also have the third moving part is TAA, Trade Adjustment Assistance. This is what Democrats want to see added, among other things, what they want to see added or attached to the Trade Promotion Authority. This is the assistance to workers who are displaced by trade deals. And so all of these are moving parts. The goal here is to get the Trans-Pacific Partnership done. The way to do that is to give the president the promotion authority. What Republicans will have to do in order to get enough Democratic votes, one of those big steps is to accept trade adjustment assistance, as well as some other language on what the actual Trans-Pacific Partnership will have. TPA, the promotion assistance, is actually a framework. Congress says, here are the goals we would like to see out of any trade deal that the president strikes. And so they actually shape what the president goes and does. And that's where the negotiations are right now. That and what sort of review Congress will have of the final deal.
I gather this is one of the largest trade agreements in U.S. history.
It's very large. It's very important. The president would really like to see it as part of his legacy. Stephen didn't even mention TTIP, but I am not going to add any more acronyms to our mix. I'm going to talk about the politics of it for a second, which are most fascinating in the House, because in the House you have this really interesting potential coalition of liberal Democrats who do not like this trade deal in particular and are worried about the impact.
Because
they're worried about the impact on workers, on jobs. They're, you know, everybody goes back and forth with their numbers about the legacy of previous
right.
trade deals. But the liberal Democrats are very concerned about giving President Obama the kind of clear path to negotiate the deal that he wants. And meanwhile, some conservative Republicans, and it goes back to the concern about giving the executive too much power, also might not be with the program. So you can see this sort of odd coalition on the left and the right that might come together to deny the president his fast-track authority.
And Jim, President Obama has had rather an evolution on trade, has he not? When you think about how Democrats generally are feeling about these trade agreements and how he has come a long way.
He's come a long ways. It's not only Democrats, but behind the Democrats, behind the liberal Democrats are strong union movements that help people get elected, help them get elected in primaries and the general election. Also environmentalists, also human rights people who are very concerned about this agreement. So we have strange bedfellows. He's talking more with the Chamber of Commerce than he is with the AFL-CIO. He's leaning towards the business position. However, when it comes to Trade Adjustment Authority. Business doesn't like it. And so it's I don't think this deal's over yet, but it's a classic bipartisan thing going on. And it's so close that I don't think we can announce that it'll pass.
Go ahead, Steve.
We were talking earlier about the effect of 2016 on all of this. We just in the last day or so saw Representative Chris Van Hollen come out against the Trade Promotion Authority. The reasoning is, the reasoning is fairly obvious. He is trying to run in a Democratic primary for the Senate seat in Maryland. Those elections, the 2016 elections, will determine a lot of what happens here. And those primaries in particular, which are what are going to happen over the next year as folks fight for their party position, are going to affect a lot of votes on this.
What about the Affordable Care Act? We have an email from Ellen who says, are Republicans likely to take more action against the ACA soon while Obama is still in office, or have we moved past symbolic votes?
We have not moved past symbolic votes. You will see one of the things, the budget that they are currently working on a deal on, and they hope to have Republicans control both House and Senate and will write this deal. The budget doesn't have a filibuster requirement there. One of the issues in there will be special. It's called reconciliation language, which is basically a budget term that is its instructions to committees to go back and do whatever the instructions are. And one of those instructions will be to repeal Obamacare and come up with a replacement. So that will be part of, there will be a budget bill that comes back eventually, most likely, that does that. The president will have a veto over that, so that's a symbolic vote. There are several other moving parts to Obamacare that aren't as symbolic. One of those is the medical device tax, which there are a number of Democrats and, I believe, just about all Republicans who think that's hurting businesses that produce these medical devices in their districts and states back home. And so there have been test votes on this medical device tax in the past, and there are, there are at least enough votes to pass it over a Democratic filibuster in the Senate.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. But, Jim, there have been, 42 votes at least to overturn the ACA. Look. Now what they're going to do is pick apart portions of it. Is that the way they're going to go?
I agree with that. There have been over 50 votes, and there'll be more. The Senate is acting like a saucer receiving the hot right-wing ire and cooling it and not dealing with that at all, except in medical device tax and a few other things. But they'll pick away at it. They'll pick away at appointments. They'll pick away at cutting budgets to make it possible to implement it. They'll also have rigorous oversight hearings. When we have divided party government, there's always more oversight hearings by the parties on the Hill against the president. We'll have a lot of them on the ACA.
And, Ruth, you mentioned Loretta Lynch has not been confirmed. How has this Congress done on nominations?
Well, when there's somebody they like Ashton Carter, the defense secretary, sails through. When there's somebody who they may or may not like, but they want to express it. You know, the great irony of Loretta Lynch being held up is that one person that Republicans seem to all agree that they would like to get out as quickly as possible, except they haven't done it, is the current Attorney General, Eric Holder.
He's still there.
We're about to reach the point where there's going to be a big slowdown on confirmations, especially when it comes to judicial confirmations, because those are lifetime appointments. I do want to go back just very quickly and make a few quick points about the Affordable Care Act. One is, the congressional role in the Affordable Care Act will be determined in significant part based on what the Supreme Court does this spring and summer in the pending case about the federal subsidies. Number two, I just can't resist noting the delicious irony that while the budget resolutions provide for the umpty-umpth repeal of the Affordable Care Act, they do not, they count significantly on the revenue from the Affordable Care Act staying in place for their claims of dealing with the deficit. And number three, the medical device tax is a really interesting issue because it illustrates the other fact of life in Congress, which is all politics is local. And so this is not a left-right issue. This is a who is in your district, what big manufacturer is in your district issue or in your state issue that affects how you think about that.
There's another element to the ACA they want to pull out.
I'm sorry, I don't know what you're referring to.
You talked earlier about not only the medical devices, but you said there was something else. Perhaps I've
slipped, but let me say something about all of these issues. Immigration, ACA, and abortion are wedge issues to help the party win a few more seats and defeat other people, and they're used by both parties. Trade will be that also, maybe, and that makes it difficult to find a coalition to govern. Because they're thinking about 2016, there are 24 seats up for the Republicans in the Senate. Now, some estimate only 5 are competitive, but it's very early, and there's 10 Democrats up. There are 3 that are competitive now. They're going to avoid votes that will hurt those people and push votes that will help them, and these wedge issues are part of that.
James Thurber of American University, Ruth Marcus of The Washington Post, Stephen Dynan of The Washington Times, all here to respond to your questions, comments, after a short break.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Arizona State University, with more than 70 campus degrees to choose from, offered 100% online, with 6 start dates a year. Learn more at online.asu.edu. From Little Brown & Company, publisher of David and Goliath, Underdogs, Misfits, and the Art of Battling Giants by Malcolm Gladwell, now in paperback. More information is available at gladwellbooks.com. And from the National Endowment for the Arts, art works.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, New York Times columnist David Brooks says, the American obsession with individual achievement and self-worth has gone too far. He argues it's time to rethink what makes a fulfilling life. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. And we're back. It's time to open the phones, 800-433-8850. Let's go first to Dallas, Texas. Hi, Thomas. You're on the air.
Hi, Diane. I just wanted to comment on your guest that said that the president has used more executive actions than other presidents. That is blatantly false.
No, sir, that's not what he said. Jim Thurber, correct the record.
Right. He's used fewer executive orders than the past 5 presidents, and he used actually no executive orders in the first 2 years. He's just started using
it. Yeah, it was a female guest that had said it. So I guess one of you guys had corrected her on that?
I actually don't need to stand corrected, but thank you. What I did say with this was that this – I don't think the right way to look at executive orders is numerically. That's one metric. But the other metric is the assertiveness, if you want to use that word, of the executive orders. And here I think that the president, very much in line with predecessors, Bill Clinton was a big expander of the executive order power, George W. Bush, this president. I think this president has pushed his powers to the maximum limits, and particularly in the immigration order, which, by the way, I believe it is legal. I think the Office of Legal Counsel analysis of that was a very thoughtful analysis. However, I'm just going to, I understand that a listener is upset, but I'm going to stand by the correctness of what
Stephen.
I said.
So one of the things about this is that counting executive orders is a bad way to judge this. The immigration actions, they are not executive orders. They are memos that were issued by the Homeland Security Department. So those don't even show up in the count of executive orders. There are many ways that the president has to take executive action. So a mere order count isn't even a good judge of that.
Jim.
But I would add to it also that he's begun to threaten vetoes, and he's actually vetoed bills. This happens at the end of a president's term, especially second-term presidents. They're double lame duck presidents in a way when you have divided party government. And so he's doing this also as a way to push his policy.
All right. To Carl in St. Petersburg, Florida, you're on the air.
Good morning, everyone.
Hi.
I would like to know the panel's perspective on whether or not the limited but I think encouraging progress we are now seeing in the Senate would have happened if Harry Reid were still the majority leader rather than Mitch McConnell. And Diane, you seldom give your opinion, but would you like to answer that as well?
No, I'm not going to answer that at all. I'm simply here to host the conversation. Go ahead, Ruth.
So I think that there has been a significant difference in the way Mitch McConnell, the new majority leader, has run the Senate compared to his predecessor, Harry Reid. Notably, Senator Reid, as majority leader, was very opposed to allowing amendments. There have been senators who had their entire career not having a single amendment voted on the floor. Senator McConnell, to his credit, has opened up that process, and I think that's been better for the Senate and for democracy.
All right. Ben, who's here in Washington, you're on the air.
Hi. My question for the guest is, you seem to be framing the Iran Congressional Oversight Bill as a defeat for the president, but it seems to me that prior to the bill passing, Congress would have needed to proactively lift sanctions on Iran that they had placed. But after passing the bill, the president will get the sanctions lifted if he wants them lifted, unless 67 senators oppose him. So it seems as if this is behind the scenes actually quite a victory for the president and something where Congress is simply passed the responsibility on and but manages to make a good show of it.
Stephen.
That's certainly the belief of some of the conservative Republicans who thought that this should be, I think as Ruth mentioned earlier, this should be treated like a treaty and therefore should be subject to a 67 or two-thirds vote threshold in the Senate. Now, there are a lot of ambiguities here, and that's essentially what Congress was dealing with, was is this a treaty? What sort of legislation does it actually qualify as? And could the president lift the sanctions or suspend or do a waiver of the sanctions unilaterally? And so this essentially gives Congress a very clear say in exactly what goes on and sets out a clear process, removes the ambiguity, and all sides, you know, it's probably better for all sides.
In fact, he cannot lift the sanctions for 52 days after the agreement comes back. That's quite a long period of time, and that gives Congress a little more power. I think it's a good thing for Congress to express itself this way. And the president, in the end, I don't think it'll limit him that much. He can always veto what they do.
I have a question here, a tweet from Jim. Is there a constitutional limit on executive actions?
Well,
there's a legal limit. They only last technically during the president's term, and it goes beyond the term, but a new president can get rid of them. They are the law during the period of the president. If another president comes in, and frequently they do, they get rid of a whole lot of executive orders that they disagree with. If a Republican came in, They would get rid of his executive orders, I'm sure.
There's another way to look at that as well, which is that the president's orders and how what's the limit of them in terms of shaping legislation and implementing the law. And this is exactly, we talked about immigration, this is exactly what's before a federal appeals court tomorrow in New Orleans. The president's newest executive actions on immigration, the ones he announced in November, are actually going before a federal appeals court. A lower judge ruled that the president acted illegally, violated the Administrative Procedures Act. But the key question in all of that is how much discretion does the president have in carrying out the law, and how much discretion can he give or can he take away from his agents, essentially ICE agents, Immigration and Customs Enforcement agents, and immigration officers who are adjudicating these applications. How much discretion do they have, and what duty do they have to the law versus to a presidential policy?
Here's an email from Dave in Boston. Are presidents truly concerned about legacy, or is this just a media notion? I thought we hired presidents and congressmen to do a job, not build a legacy.
Well, I think that's what President Clinton might call a false choice. Presidents want to do their job, which is to achieve, set out and achieve the goals that they have for taking the country in the direction they think it should be taken, or to protect the country in the ways that they think it should be protected. And that is all part of their legacy. So I don't think that there is any real daylight that I see between the job that you're doing day to day and the legacy that you're building for the future.
Plus, they believe in what they've done. He passed 338 bills, became law in the first 2 years. It's significant amount of legislation. He believes in it. He thinks it's good public policy. He wants to hang on to it. And that is a legacy also. It's not just about him, his hubris personally. It's a legacy of doing good in his mind, and he wants to continue it.
One issue we haven't talked about, well, a number we haven't talked about. Two, I'm particularly interested in minimum wage. Will we see action on that and action on infrastructure? You'd take the first, Steve, on minimum wage.
So with Republicans in control of both chambers, you will very unlikely that you will see action on minimum wage out of Congress. The president has already taken steps, more executive action, to require a higher minimum wage for federal contractors, those who do business with the federal government. And that, you know, that does have an effect. That sort of sets a standard for at least certain types of businesses, and then other businesses need to address that if they want to compete with that and whatnot. So that's where the president's executive actions can have a knock-on effect through the rest of the economy.
I wonder whether the private sector in and of itself is going to move on this a lot more aggressively. You saw this young man out in Seattle talk about taking his income down from mm-hmm. 1.1 million in order to raise his employee's salary to 70,000, and he himself take a 70,000 salary.
As the economy improves, there will be more demand for labor, and companies will, and we've already seen this in a number of companies, have that impetus to, on their own, without legislation, raise the minimum wage, raise the wages that they are paying.
Of course.
And so that is going to be a piece of the Republican argument against action.
Seattle's a special place. You know, it's pretty liberal. They have a $15 minimum wage in that city. And I want to mention this because many states and more municipalities are putting in minimum wages. And so the progress is being made in the states and localities, as it is in many other areas of policy when there's gridlock back here. I think that progressive businesses will move on this, but localities will also.
Mm-hmm. What about on infrastructure? Any likelihood in the Congress?
I think there is a coalition of people that want to fill potholes. They don't want bridges to collapse. The infrastructure bill, the so-called highway bill, has been on a continuing resolution for several years, meaning they didn't do anything with it. They need to fund it. And I think you find Democrats and Republicans, even Tea Party people on the far right, that want this bill to be passed. I think it will be passed, probably overwhelmingly.
You had parts of a walking bridge fall yesterday and either injure or kill someone. They've got to do something.
Well, Ruth had talked earlier about what greased the skids on the Medicare bill was the fact that they did deficit spending. That's the problem. When Congress, we were able to get a lot of things done in the over the last decade when everybody was willing to spend more money and not pay for it. The issue with the highway bill is, where do you get the funding to fully fund those needs? And that's going to be the main sticking point. If the Medicare bill is an example and Republicans are willing to deficit spend on that, it'll be a lot easier to get a deal.
By the way, that company's name is Gravity Payments in Seattle. Probably lots of folks going to rush out there to Seattle. Let's go to Jeff on Kent Island, Maryland. You're on the air.
Thank you. I wanted to ask the panel their opinion on the TPP. I have yet to be able to figure out what advantage it would be to the American public versus the numerous advantages it shows for the multinational corporations, and that if it passes, they will have the power, the corporations, to literally sue our government.
Jim.
Well, I think the argument is that if we don't have a free trade agreement with the nations in the Pacific Rim, they will do it without us. It's like outlawing gravity, you know, when it comes to a worldwide economic system. And if we're not part of it, we're going to be hurt. The argument is that free trade helps us. Yes, we have a shift in kinds of jobs that we have here, and we certainly saw that after NAFTA. But in the long run, it brings more wealth to the United States because we pay less for products, and also we can export our products, and these companies can be healthy. Now, unions disagree. We won't go through all those arguments, but that's the argument, and it's persuasive with Republicans and many Democrats.
You're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's go to Ken in Cincinnati, Ohio. You're on the air.
Ken or Jim?
Ken. I have Ken in front of me.
Okay. I wanted to ask why I have heard nothing about Obama considering a congressional executive order on the treaty with Iran.
Ken or Jim, I'm a little confused.
Yeah,
on a number of levels. First, we've been talking actually about the deal that was forged this week, whereby the president has wanted sort of clear sailing on his deal with Iran. The Senate and I presume the House will assert their authority. So that's where we are. It's not quite such a thing as a congressional executive order, though.
But it was a unanimous vote in the Senate Foreign Relations Committee to pass the Iran Nuclear Agreement Review Act, which gives them the right to review this and exerts their power vis-a-vis
right.
the president.
And, Stephen, let's talk about the coming Republican budget negotiations. What are we likely to see from that?
So both the House and Senate passed their budgets. They both reach balance in about 10 years. They are within the decade. They take a couple of different procedures to get there, but these are very similar budgets, which will make a final agreement likely. The two big things in there are the reconciliation instructions. The first is on Obamacare. The second is on tax reform. And so these are basically their broad powers that Congress can use to write a tax simplification, tax code overhaul stand to write whatever they want to do with Obamacare, and those can pass through the Senate without having to deal with a filibuster, though they do still have to survive a presidential veto. The tax issue is a much more likely area for bipartisan cooperation, obviously, than the Obamacare repeal.
Do you agree with that, Ruth?
Because there is no way, we had a question earlier about legacy, because there is no way that the president is going to allow the central part of his legacy to be dismantled while he still has a veto pen in his hand. That is going, as Stephen said, absolutely nowhere. Tax reform is the ultimate goal that everybody agrees is necessary, and no one can get to any sort of agreement on the details. And, you know, whether you look at some of the green shoots of compromise that we've seen in various arenas, including on Iran this week, as a hopeful sign of tax reform has so many different moving parts and so many different very powerful and competing constituencies. I guess I'm not particularly sanguine about that.
Two comments about the budget resolution. Concurrent budget resolution has to be the same out of the House and the Senate, and it's instructions to committees to do things. That doesn't mean that they have the votes to do those things in the committee or on the floor. But one area of tax reform that looks like it's moving is the estate tax, to revise that, to really get rid of that. Secondly, sequestration, it's a fancy word for automatic cuts, meat axe cuts for the military and domestic spending. They're trying to fix that also from the 2011 Balanced Budget Act that they passed.
Give me a single letter, a grade, that you would give to this Congress.
I'd give them a C on lawmaking and a B on oversight.
Ruth?
Can I give them an incomplete? Otherwise, Jim's the professor. I'll go with his grade.
All right. And Stephen?
I'd give them a C-plus up from the previous Congress, D-plus.
All right. Stephen Dynan of the Washington Times, Ruth Marcus of the Washington Post, James Thurber of the American University. Thank you all.
Thanks a lot. It was fun.
Great.
And thanks all for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkert, Denise Couture, Susan Casey, Rebecca Kaufman, Lisa Dunn, Danielle Knight, Allison Brody, and Alexandra Boti. The engineer is Timothy Olmstead.